What if this isn't a climate crisis, but the greatest opportunity humanity has had in a long time? Lean Into Clean will explore and discuss with highly esteemed guests on what could be the new spirals for society, sustainability, spirituality and social harmony. Perhaps we've all lost our way. Lean Into Clean will showcase how we might remember, refocus and restore the natural ways so we can again live in balance and harmony with life on Earth and all its inhabitants. Welcome back to Lean Into Clean. I'm Jarvis Smith. This is UK Health Radio. And today I'm joined by a man who's spent his whole life immersed in the natural world, quite literally, since he was a toddler, tagging along on his naturalist father's bird watching trips back in the early 1960s. He became the very first conservationist appointed to the Thames catchment in 1984, went on to serve 15 years as National Head of Conservation at the Environment Agency, and since 2016 has been one of the leading voices bringing rewilding into the mainstream in Britain as director of Rewilding Britain. He's an honorary professor at the University of Exeter, an ambassador for Journeys with Purpose, and he's visited more than 50 countries chasing conservation success stories, and recently won the Lifetime Achievement Award for our very own People Environment Achievement Awards. Professor Alistair Driver, a very, very warm welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jarvis. It's great to be here.
To have you. I know you're a busy guy, and often we're good to catch you inside and not walking the outside, keeping an eye on things.
Yeah, and catching me in the country because I'm about to fly off to America on Wednesday to see family.
Oh yes. Well, look, before we get to what you're going to be doing next, let's go back in time a little bit. Let's start at the very beginning. I think you've said somewhere that you were clinging on to your naturalist father's coattails on birding trips as a toddler. Yeah. How much of who you are today do you trace back to those early days?
Well, certainly he massively inspired me to understand more about nature and understand what things were. Identifying birds and butterflies and moths and plants was part of my upbringing as a very small child. And, you know, to be honest, I was probably hot-housed, you know, to be honest. It was all books, no TV. Literally, as soon as I could walk, I was with him on these birding trips, 3-4 year old. He did have a tape of me reciting or identifying all the birds in the British Birds Book at the age of 4, identifying them by name. So, yeah, nice. I imagine I was pretty geeky as a kid.
but clearly you enjoyed it because you continued the path. I mean, yeah, it got your imagination.
Yeah, I mean, I think knowing what stuff was a massive advantage. And certainly when I went to university, I did ecology at the first university to do ecology in this country, Lancaster.
Right.
It was only the second year of that course, and there were only 20 people on that course. So it was a very rare degree.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I scraped through. I struggled with the academic examination stuff. But in the field, I was totally, you know, in my comfort zone.
And, yeah.
You know, I do remember sort of pointing things out to the tutors because they didn't know what they were looking at.
Yeah, very good. Best classroom. You remind me of my daughter a little bit. She's very much like that. She can pick out the birds and, you know, all the animals, and is often correcting us when we get something wrong. So let's move forward to 1984. So you became the first ever conservationist for the Thames catchment. Was that Thames Water?
It was Thames Water Authority because that was 5 years before privatisation. So
right.
It was basically a mix of what the Thames Water PLC now do, i.e. water supply, sewage disposal. But it also included a lot of what the Environment Agency do, pollution control, fisheries, navigation, water resource management, etc. So it was the entire catchment, and it was the Thames catchment, 5,000 square miles of England, covering or touching on 14 different counties. And it was just an incredible opportunity. It was the first of its kind. I was literally the first full-time person doing this conservation officer job for any water authority. And I sort of made it up as I went along in those early years. You know, literally there were no rules. There was just one piece of legislation, the Wildlife and Countryside Act, that told water authorities they had to further conservation when carrying out their functions. And it was my job to make it happen. And gradually I built a department over the years.
Oh, amazing, amazing. So you kind of set the tone. What was the state of the rivers back then?
Well,
And what
interesting. I mean, first of all, you know, the habitat on there was a lot less habitat on riverbanks because they were dredging rivers relentlessly in those days. There were
Right.
literally gangs of dredgers and banksmen clearing riverbanks throughout the catchment in those days. And that, you know, something that I'm, you know, proud of is that I managed to help to get a more rational approach to that, because a lot of it was just being done because they've always did it, you know, and there wasn't actually a good scientific reason or a hydrological reason, flood risk reason why they were doing it, just because they'd always done it. So the riverbanks and the riverside habitat was poorer, but the water quality was recovering from, you know, historic pollution. But to be honest, now I look at the water quality, and we can maybe come back to this later, but you know, I couldn't honestly say the water quality is significantly better now than it was 40 odd years ago.
That's a sh yeah,
But the
that's
habitat above water level is definitely better.
yeah. Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. I mean, I remember the River Thames. It was described as a biological death, I think, at one stage, and then
Yeah,
it
in the
went on to
50s.
winning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it went on to winning an international restoration prize, didn't it? I mean, it's quite
Well,
a
yeah, I had the privilege of being the recipient of that award, the International River Prize, it was called, and we won that in 2010 in Australia. And you know, I oversaw putting the bid together and persuaded the bosses to let me do it and raise the money to travel to Australia to pay for my flights, and not knowing whether we'd won.
Wow.
And a bit like your event the other day,
Yes.
and yeah, came back with a $350,000 check and a very nice trophy for the cleanup of the Thames, not for me, but for the Thames
For
and
the
the
Thames.
thousands of people that have contributed over 50 years or so.
Yeah, amazing.
But honestly, now I look at that and I think, oh God, you know, I almost feel like we ought to give it back after what's happened in the last 15 years.
Yeah, well, what has happened? I mean, where have things gone so horribly wrong?
Well, I'm afraid it's human nature and in, to be specific, human greed. You know, when we privatized the water industry in this country, you know, I thought, well, this can work. You know, it's worth trying. I wasn't opposed to it, but what I and lots of others didn't account for is that inevitably human nature means that shareholders and chief execs, etc., will always take slightly more from the pie than they should do. And they were investing less than they should have done into upgrading sewage works and infrastructure to cope with a growing population, to cope with more extreme rainfall events, etc. And sadly, the regulator, indeed, some of my colleagues in the Environment Agency and Ofwat, the government regulatory body, were not tough enough on this as time progressed. And we are now in a position where we have this massive legacy of underinvestment because shareholders and executive salaries have been you know, overinflated.
So the money's literally flowing in the wrong direction.
Indeed. And made even worse, Jarvis, by the fact that companies from other countries have come in and bought up the business and then sold it later without really any care for what environmental condition it's been left in, and so it's a very sorry state of affairs.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. I mean, we live next to the River Wharfe, and there are some spots here that are supposed to be clean enough for swimming, but it's a rare thing, and they have to be monitored regularly. And that's just one of many, many rivers around the UK that are kind of unbathable. So God
Yeah.
knows what it's doing to the environment. But let's look at your passion for animals. And you spent years championing the water vole, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, when I was head of conservation for the EA, at that time there was a government biodiversity strategy and action plan, and there was a whole list of species that the government decided through expert advice needed special conservation and action.
Yeah.
And staff, expert staff in all sorts of organizations, charities, environmental charities, environment agency, and other places were asked to put their hand up to lead on a species. So I put my hand up for water vole because I had already by then commissioned research with Oxford University, Wildcrew at Oxford University. Which proved that the American mink, the escape of American mink, had been a significant contributory factor to the massive decline of water voles that we had been seeing in the 80s and 90s, a 95% reduction in the species. So I led on that for 20 years, and I can't say we've significantly reversed the decline, but I genuinely believe all of the various actions we put in place, including, by the way, I wrote the case for the legal protection of water voles under the Wildlife and Countryside Act, which was successful. All of those actions, I think, have prevented it from becoming extinct.
Amazing, amazing. I want to kind of come up to date with what you do currently, which is about the rewilding. But before we do that, I guess before your early retirement space, because you actually came back into work very quickly. Is there anything significant that you remember about your time in the early years that you think, wow, that was amazing, or God, I wish I'd done that differently? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, the things that there are things that I'm proud of. When I started in the Water Authority, it was just me as a conservation officer. There were 10,000 people working for the organization,
Yeah, it's
and
remarkable, isn't it?
3,000 of those were doing stuff that was potentially damaging to the environment.
Yeah.
Engineers building stuff and dredging rivers and plastering them with concrete and flood alleviation schemes, etc. And so what I am very proud of is the fact that we did turn things around, and we did get over a period of years with and lots of allies in other departments, fisheries, and indeed some of the engineers became my best allies because they
Yeah.
got it.
Yeah.
They could see what that we needed to be far more sustainable in our activities and look at other designs for schemes other than just concrete and steel. And I'm very pleased to say there are a lot of routine practices now that we pioneered in the 80s and 90s, which are have evolved even further. Some of the things I did and the materials we used, I wouldn't use now because things have moved on even better since then. And then I've got individual projects which I'm very proud of, like the London Wetland Centre, the Otmore RSPB Reserve, the Jubilee River at Maidenhead. These are big, big schemes
Yeah.
that I had, had the privilege of having a key role in helping to make happen.
Ah, brilliant. Absolutely. But well, thank you. I'm sure everybody listening is in a huge appreciation, because we're in this thing called a climate crisis, and I'm wondering whether that's what brought you back into the game. But so you took an early retirement. It
Yeah.
was, I mean, it was really from, I guess, from public service, and that was in
Yeah.
2016, so a decade ago.
That's right. There was an opportunity to leave. I mean, every couple of years by then, there were threats of redundancy,
Yeah.
and it was really hard. I was manager of a by then and big national team, and it was really difficult. But I was also getting to the point where I felt I couldn't speak out on things because there had been a sort of clamping down on communications in the organization, and the comms department then was part of DEFRA, not separate, not in the
Yeah.
Environment Agency, but actually clawed into DEFRA. And so for all these reasons, and more, I decided it was time for a change. I had no intention of stopping. And indeed, 3 months later, after leaving on so-called early retirement, and a lot of my friends thought I was retiring. I was 60 years old then. A lot of people thought I would hang up my boots, but there was no chance. It was never going to happen. And within 3 months, I was a director of Rewilding Britain, and that was supposed to be temporary, but I ended up doing it for 8 years.
And what was the what was the, I mean, well, tell me what happened in that period. So you retired 3 months later, you're back in a role. What happened? Did you get headhunted, or did
No,
you see?
actually, I just saw the job advertised, and it was a temporary role, maternity cover for a lady who was going to come back probably, but in the end she didn't come back after maternity, and so I took on the role. I said when I took it on that I didn't want to manage people anymore. I had a great time managing a wonderful team in the EA, at the EA head office, and that was great. But I just wanted to be out there, so I said I want to be out there advising landowners across the country. And in and out of Westminster and Number 10, chipping away at politicians and policymakers, because I'd done a fair bit of that in the EA. I want to do those two things because that's where I think you'll get your biggest bang for the buck from me. That's where I can contribute most and best. And so I stuck to that throughout my 8 years, even though when I joined Rewilding Britain, there were only three or four of us. And when I left, there were over 30. But I stuck to that, so other people were brought in to manage people,
Yeah, amazing. Well, I mean, for anyone who's never come across the term rewilding, I want to get into that. But before we do that, let's go to our first commercial break, because I think this is a good opportunity. And after the break, we'll talk about, rewilding, what it is to you, how important it is to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. So don't go away. We'll be back with Alistair very, very soon.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
So let's talk about this word rewilding. I mean, there's a few kind of myths and suspicions around rewilding, but we'll get into that in a minute. But how would you best describe the word, and how is it different from, traditional conservation?
Well, the tweetable definition I give is the large-scale restoration of ecosystems to the point where nature is allowed to take care of itself.
Nice.
Now, that's as short as I can get, and is that contains several key words: large scale, the whole ecosystem, and to the point, or the phrase to the point where nature is allowed to take care of itself, i.e., allowed by man to take care of itself. Now, you could replace the word to the point with towards the point in this country, because it will take decades, if not a century or more, for us to get to that point, because we don't have apex predators and a lot of the large herbivores. So if we never get those things back, it won't quite be at the point where nature is truly taking care of itself, because we'll have to sort of be the wolf, for example, if we don't have it. But so that's the first thing to say: large scale restoration of ecosystems to the point where nature is allowed to take care of itself. Now, the difference between that and traditional conservation, and I should say, I am 48 years now a professional conservationist. Most of that time, and still to this day, I still do traditional conservation. I manage a nature reserve that I created in my village. I sometimes, at Broughton, where I oversee on the groundwork, we have traditional conservation practices going on there, sitting alongside rewilding. So it's I'm not, it's not one or the other. We need both. But the difference with rewilding is that you are basically putting nature first. That's the first thing to say. and you are letting nature evolve, and you're operating at such a scale that it doesn't matter if you have a few losers, nature losers in part of the site, i.e. things perhaps disappear or become more scarce, because the chances are you will have many, many more winners because you're operating at big scale. Whereas in conservation, because a lot of conservation has been quite small sites, like the site I manage is 2 acres, it's a tiny site. In that situation, you want to try and maintain the best biodiversity you can from the site. And that means probably managing quite small habitats, a meadow here, a pond there, a hedgerow there, which is exactly what we have in the site I look after. And, you need to manage that. That's human intervention, keeping the best of that site as it is. So, because if I walked away from my local nature reserve, it would all be covered in brambles in 10 years, because we've got bramble in the hedgerows. But if you're operating on a 1,000 hectare rewilding site, it wouldn't matter if you had, a few hundred square meters of bramble. And anyway, if you had wild boar or INH pigs in there, rootling things around, they'd soon break it up and create a mosaic. So it's basically the difference between sort of managing to preserve certain habitats and plant communities, compared with rewilding, letting things go and develop naturally.
Yeah, nice. And what about this kind of myth side of things? I know, often people think that rewilding is about abandoning land. I mean, you've already covered that, but I think more importantly, bringing back animals that people are nervous about, like you mentioned the wolf. What do you find yourself having to correct most often?
So the first thing on this land abandonment thing, there are two. The first thing to say is there are two types of rewilding. There's active rewilding and passive rewilding. And passive rewilding is walking away and doing nothing and letting it develop naturally. And there are plenty of places around the world where that happens. And actually, I know a couple of sites in England where that's happened. One is an MOD site behind a fence in Surrey, 1,000 acres, rifle range. Nobody ever does anything in there apart from shoot a few rifles across it. And one guy comes in every so often and shoots half a dozen red deer. Nothing else happens in the site, hasn't done for about 40 years. And I've been in there with the security guys. It is truly amazing, fantastic. It's wonderful. Now, that's fine because those habitats were already pretty good to start with. They were a mixture of mire and heath and fen and woodland and scrub. It was already probably very nature rich when that process started. But most of the sites I deal with are unproductive or marginally productive farmland, which are heavily degraded in terms of their biodiversity value. So just walking away, like if we walked away at Broughton and just left it, it would take decades, if not a century or more, for trees and scrub to come back, in significant quantities, because there were so few trees there to start with. So, for example, tree planting in particularly in some of the upland sites is a desirable early intervention as part of a rewilding process. And other things like, breaking up land drains, rewiggling rivers, restoring rivers, reconnecting them with their floodplain, creating habitat piles, introducing leaky dams because you haven't got beavers, but replicating what they might do, and removing intensive grazing, perhaps re replacing it with extensive cattle grazing, just small numbers of cattle. So these are interventions, and they constitute active rewilding. And the vast majority of projects in England do that because we haven't got the time to sit back and wait 100 years. We're too late by then.
It's giving it a little nudge, isn't it?
So that's the first myth. It's not about not it's rarely about land abandonment, very rarely. Secondly, not including people. Well, that's a complete myth. I always say Homo sapiens is a species that belongs in the natural environment just as much as a mosquito or a marbled white butterfly or a great crested newt. We've been here 200,000 years or so on this planet. We belong there. The challenge is, can we be there without impacting detrimentally on other things? And the answer is yes, we can if we want to. It's quite possible, quite feasible. So people have to be included, communities have to be included, And actually, what I've shown with the data I've collected over the last 10 years or so is that you get a more than doubling of jobs as a result of rewilding in these
Nice.
places, and you get a more than tenfold increase in volunteer engagement because I've collected the data from lots of sites.
Yeah,
So,
that's a
that's
brilliant.
another myth, and then we could talk about food, the food production myth, if you want as well. That's another one that comes up
Yeah,
regularly.
let's do that because food is such an important thing, particularly now with everything that's going on and the national emergency paper that DEFRA participating in food scarcity. So yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, so again, it's a very easy sort of throwaway line. Oh, how are we going to feed the world if you rewild everywhere? And there's several things to say to that. First of all, nobody's rewilding everywhere. The current level of rewilding in Britain is about 2% of the country, and the vast majority of that is in Scotland, in the uplands. There's about 0.5% of England and Wales that's a rewilding, and that is in the unproduct mainly in the unproductive uplands. 70% of Britain is farmed, so there's some really striking stats. 2% of Britain rewilding, 70% farm. First, that's first one. Second one is we waste 40% of the food we produce to eat. That might be coming down, so maybe it's closer to 35%, but it's still an absurd, obscene, ridiculous proportion of the food that we produce to eat that doesn't get eaten by humans. So if we're really serious about food, so-called food security, and really what we mean is food independence, not security, food independence, then we need to be looking seriously at that because it just should not happen in this day and age. Then we look at,
Absolutely.
sorry, and then we look at what do these rewilding projects actually produce? And actually, they still produce food because we're having to use cattle and pigs as proxies for wild boar and the ancient aurochs that we once had. So these things get harvested, and the data I've collected shows that they produce about half the food that they used to produce before rewilding. So it's not no food, it's half, and it's all really good quality food. And the general trend is that these sites switch from large numbers of sheep, i.e., producing lamb, to small numbers of cattle producing high quality beef. And when you factor in the fact that a third of our lamb is exported, so not all of that lamb was going to be eaten in this country anyway, coming off the sites. And you factor in that all of this high quality beef gets eaten locally or regionally, doesn't get exported. It's actually, one could argue an onshoring of food consumption rather than an offshoring, which is what often gets thrown at us. So there's all of that. And then I'll leave you one final stat, Jarvis, and that is, and it's in Henry Dimbleby's National Food Strategy, 20% of Britain produces 3% of our calories. That's mainly the uplands and the poor, very poor soils on clay, etc., in the lowlands. And that's where the majority of rewilding takes place. So 3% of the calories. And if you remember what I said, these sites produce half. So that's 1.5% that's been lost. And then you remember that we waste 40% of the food we produce to eat. It really is not an issue. If we were to knock, 5% off the food waste problem, you'd could easily rewild 20% of Britain with no impact whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Well, I'm all for that. And I'd love to talk about in detail, I guess one of the most successful projects in the UK to date, which is Broughton. You've mentioned it a couple of times. It's funny because when you first started working there, Katie and I were living there, so it's very, very close to our hearts as well. But before we do that, Alistair, I always ask my guests to bring me a couple of songs, and I know this was really hard for you to pick two songs, but songs that are soundtracks to your life's work. And tell us the first song we're going to play and why you've chosen it.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll just say that it took me half the journey back from Broughton yesterday to work out my two songs.
I know how difficult that is. People say to me, "What's your favorite song?" And I say, "Well, there's a top 20."
Well, I've got these massive playlists, which I love. Anyway, I've settled for Early Morning Rain, which is a very well-known song, written by Gordon Lightfoot many years ago, but I love the Paul Weller version of this, and that's because it reminds me of quite I've done quite a lot of traveling in my time, advising around the world, and it, sometimes I felt quite homesick, especially in the early years when I just wasn't used to it. And this song always reminds me of it. And my beautiful and long-suffering wife, Belinda, loves this song as well. So this is for her.
Lovely. So this is Early Morning Rain by Paul Weller's version. Thank you. What a great record. Thanks for choosing that, Alistair. How's it feel hearing that?
Yeah, I just love it. Almost brings tears to my eyes.
It's a powerful song, isn't it?
I love
Gritty.
it. Yeah.
Good stuff. So let's before we talk about Broughton, which I really, really want to get into because I know you've done an amazing job there. What are the key ingredients that helped a landowner, somebody that runs the Broughton Hall estate? What were the key ingredients that brought you and them together?
Well, yeah, the first thing to say is that it was a routine for me as part of my job with Rewilding Britain at the time to visit landowners across the country, private, public, NGO, anyone who had a decent area of land who wanted to talk, wanted to find out more about rewilding. Perhaps they're already on the journey, or perhaps they were just considering it. I would go and pay them a visit, and I visited over 200 sites in my 8 years there, and I totted it up, and actually it was in excess of a quarter of a million acres of land that I visited and advised on in
Wow.
that time. And what so I would go and I'd spend a day or best part of a day with the landowners or the land managers, finding out more about what their aspirations were. Why did they want to get into rewilding in the first place? If they did, maybe they weren't even sure.
Yeah.
Explaining to them what it meant, what would you have to do? What interventions would be necessary to kickstart recovery? Where might the money come from? What might the implications be for jobs? How would things need to change? And in so doing, in the space of a day, which I would then follow up with some simple recommendations by email. In the space of a day's visit, I could pretty much know for sure, A, whether the landowner was truly and properly committed and whether their heart was in the right place, B, whether the land was suitable for rewilding, and C, wh whether I felt that it could work economically, socioeconomically, not just environmentally. And in this particular case, the answer to all those things was yes, it was definitely viable. I knew straight away Roger and Paris's heart was in the right place. They were doing it for the right reasons. They knew they wanted to leave a better legacy for future generations as the 32nd generation at that site, which is truly extraordinary.
Yeah, thousand year
Thousand
owned
year,
estate,
yeah,
isn't
a
it?
thousand
Yeah,
years, just remarkable.
it is.
And so I then thought, well, actually, I need a site where I need to be more involved on an ongoing basis because I can learn from that in terms of my political influencing, where there are policies and procedures and funding things that have got blockers, unnecessary blockers that I could untangle. I could take them to Westminster and I'd have a real life example that I could cite. And it's been massively useful for that.
Amazing, amazing, and you did do that. There was some nature recovery financing that came in, and some policy shifts.
Two big policies which I got tweaks on, which was tree planting densities. They were far too dense, the planting requirements when we started. Got those watered down a little bit, so it's a bit more naturalistic. And also planting within the 1 kilometre of a breeding wader site, I got the rules flexed a bit on that to make it more practical and more realistic again for things to happen.
Amazing, amazing. So we're going to go to the second commercial break because I think this would be a good moment too. But then I would really want to get under the skin of Broughton, what you came up against. How was the land? And there's a lot of agricultural land there. Knowing Roger, it's absolutely right that he wanted to turn the place around for future generations, which is a beautiful thing. But there was some resistance to it. The farmers were not happy in the local area. So we'll talk about that in a second. Don't go away.
the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So let's get into to Boughton Hall. Is it a, roughly a 6,000 acre estate now? Is that
no,
roughly
no, no, right? No, 2,500.
Two and a half thousand, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. My apologies. And you know, this is up in North Yorkshire. Quite close to Skipton. If anybody's in the Yorkshire area, you'll probably know Boughton Hall. It's now Boughton Sanctuary. So you arrived on the land. You met the owners. You knew they were committed. This is an estate that's been around for 1,000 years by the same family. So what came next?
Well, it was clear that one of the obvious major interventions that was going to be necessary was removing intensive sheep grazing from some of the less productive land and replacing that with trees, basically, because there was only about 5% tree cover on the estate, and indeed in that borough as a whole, that Craven district as a whole. So getting trees and scrub back in a landscape and allowing the grassland to roughen up was a very obvious first step.
Yeah.
And fortunately, there were two things that made this possible. First of all, Roger had quite a lot of the land covered by annual grazing licenses, which were grazed by sheep farmers who had their own farms elsewhere and had other land elsewhere that they could graze. So terminating a few fields of grazing licenses to an individual farmer didn't have a massive impact on those individuals because they had their own farms and other land. So that was done in, you know, the early years. That freed up the land for us to plant. And the other very fortunate thing that happened was that the White Rose Forest was established to promote tree planting projects in its area, which covers much of Yorkshire. And that was funded by the Nature for Climate Fund, a government funding initiative, which I personally had the pleasure of helping to get off the ground in the first place, because I was working for Rewilding Britain and we produced a national petition which got 100,000 signatures in 7 weeks, which generated a parliamentary debate, which I briefed ministers for. And that petition was calling for significant funding for nature restoration at scale to help tackle climate change. And so this Nature for Climate Fund was set up as a direct result of that debate, that petition and that debate. And there I was a couple of years later on the receiving end as part of the team at Broughton of the money that paid for what has turned out to be 330,000 native trees and shrubs in the ground. A really nice circle, you know, fate for me personally. And that scheme, that White Rose Forest scheme, has been absolutely fantastic. We couldn't have done it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, I drive down, I drive past there often, and it's amazing to see. What is it? So it must be two and a half, three. Are they in the third year now?
It's always longer than you think. It's now 5.5 years since that first phase.
Is it really? Wow.
Yeah. 5.5 years.
But they look to be completely abundant. You know, you drive down the main road, you get to, you know, the two roundabouts at each end, and you know, there's just trees everywhere now. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. No, I mean, we've had over 85% survival. So bear in mind, we were having to plant too densely, really, for my liking, at 1600 stems per hectare. So we, you know, we've got way more than we need. So there will need to be some thinning done in due course. But they've done very well. It's, you know,
very
I
well.
Cannot believe, I was there last week, and just the growth of some of these trees are 15 foot plus tall now. And they were planted as, sorry, I'm mixing my my measurements, but 40 centimeter whips, you know, like, you know, just sort of 18 inches or so, you know.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So they're clearly thriving. And yeah. I've heard some really lovely stories about wildlife coming back. And I think, you know, the The family had already stopped hunting on the land, I think, way before the rewilding projects, and even fishing in the rivers and all kinds of stuff. But what are the success stories of this rewilding project? So you let the grasslands come back, the trees are in the ground. What else has happened?
Well, the first thing that happens, and the first thing you notice, and it was probably obvious within a year or 18 months, was the sheer increase in bioabundance of little things. Millions and millions of invertebrates, grasshoppers, flies, hoverflies, bees, butterflies, moths. My moth trapping went through the roof. I went from
Yeah, I
30 to
remember we helped you with some of that, didn't we, when we were there?
That's right. And I was going, I was going from sort of 30 to 50 moths on a decent night in one location before rewilding to, 500 to 1,000 in a trap in one night, in one
Really?
trap. Yeah.
Wow.
Just staggering numbers. Voles and mice, the numbers went through the roof. Again, that then led to a rapid increase in barn owls and kestrels. We've just ringed 21 barn owl chicks and 21 kestrel chicks this last few weeks. Had them ringed up and
Gosh,
stuff.
that's amazing.
Birds of prey followed. What we're seeing now steadily is new things coming in. So just yesterday, I got first confirmation of a baby, a young grey partridge, which I actually posted on my Instagram account, Rewilding Driver account. Young grey partridge, they've just appeared. We've red kites have started breeding. Short-eared owls turned up, long-eared owls. So we have all five species of British owl there now.
Wow.
Pied flycatch have turned up recently, and hopefully will breed. So we're every week passes, something new appears. And we
Yeah.
keep a record of everything. We've literally, thanks to our amazing volunteers, particularly David Coburn, who's recording literally every species of every kind, we've got this growing list of, well, it's over 2,000 species and rising. So, yeah,
Wow. I mean, it's
I mean, the
such a
wildlife,
success
honestly,
story.
Jarvis, the wildlife is, it blows my mind when I go there. And I've seen probably
Yeah.
more sights than pretty much anyone in this country. And I could tell you this one
Yeah.
is the most transformational. And then the other really important thing
Yeah.
is that we're noticing a reduction in local flooding on the roads, where, in a
Right.
similar rainfall event before rewilding, we were getting water on the roads because it's rushing off the slopes across
Oh
the
yeah, I mean
plains.
I lived on one of the roads that used to get
That's
flooded
it.
at least once or twice. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that doesn't flood anymore because the whole site's acting as a great sponge. So, we're seeing that immediate impact on reducing flood risk locally.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Absolutely brilliant. Well done. I do want to make sure we get your second song in, but what I think we'll do, if it's all right with you, we'll play it at the very end of the conversation so it can be an outro to the show. We've got 10 minutes left. So there's a couple of key things I want to ask you, and I think this is important, just for everybody that's listening. So, if listeners are feeling overwhelmed by the state of nature, and doesn't really know where to begin. Is there something meaningful they can do? Even in a garden or in a local green space, or if you want to be a bit more adventurous, engage the community. What are the actions that people can take?
Well, let me just preface that by just saying, as you probably know, I'm now the senior advisor for the Global Rewilding Alliance. When I left Rewilding Britain a year ago, I went global straight away. And so obviously now I,
As you do.
yeah, as you do. And obviously in that capacity, I'm dealing with huge sites, or people that are setting up massive projects, millions of hectares, or
Yeah.
and it's mind-boggling some of the stuff we're seeing around the world now. But we can all do our little bit at home, and I do encourage people to do that. And I forgive me for repeating this phrase, but it's one I think I used in the speech the other day at your awards, and I it's one I like to trot out regularly, and that is, if you think you're too small to make a difference, you should try spending a night in a tent with a mosquito. And that really is exactly why I would encourage people to do what they can in their garden, no matter how small. And I've got a tiny garden. I've got a pond that is smaller than, a breakfast table. And if you can create a pond in your garden, run the roof drainage off it, which is relatively easy to do, run it down a drain pipe, T junction into a pond, line
Yeah.
the pond, and make sure that you plant it with good native species, you will have hours of joy looking at the amazing wildlife that turns up. Frogs, newts, dragonflies, mayflies, pond snails, pond skaters, water boatmen. They'll all come. They'll all come. And they come very quickly because most of the insects actually fly. You know, water people don't realize pond skaters, water boatmen, water beetles, they all fly. They all colonize ponds by flying there. So that would, you know, so pollinator-rich species in the borders, a wildlife pond, a boggy area, a log pile, a bit of open compost heap, that sort of thing. In just one corner of the garden, you will be amazed at what turns up. The other thing that I would always encourage people to do, if they're particularly into the idea of rewilding, big scale stuff, wanting to get involved, find out where your nearest rewilding site is and try and get involved as a volunteer in those sites. And we've had some amazing volunteers rock up at Broughton, you know, contact us and are now involved in bat monitoring and dragonflies. And as I say, this one guy recording everything. Bird surveys, you know, you name it, there are people quite expert wanting to do it, and it's just brilliant.
Yeah, amazing. It's funny because it's been going through my mind here for us to have a pond. We've got the space for it, and I've just been taking some notes there. You've just re-inspired me. What's a good time of year to get your pond?
Well, better to do it towards the end of the summer, August, September. September's a good month because it's usually very dry in September. And then you've done it in good time for it to colonize before next spring when things really kick off.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah, September, October is a good time to create it.
Great. So some great bits of advice there. So you got your personal one is if you have got space to have a pond, and if not, then you get involved with your local rewilding project because there will be one near it where everybody is around the country, right?
That's right, absolutely. Yeah. So you can, you know, go on to the I mean, you can go on to the Global Rewilding Alliance, the charity I work for, and see where some of the really big projects are. And we do have several UK projects as part of our membership of over 300 organisations and projects around the world. And also, Rewilding Britain has a map on their website of various projects.
Great. So people can search for Global Rewilding and Rewilding Britain, and they're both sites that will have information for them. Thank you very much.
Great.
So let's just look at 10 years ahead, or even 20 years ahead. Are you optimistic about nature recovery in Britain, in the world? You know, is it looking good for us?
Well, the answer is I am optimistic because all of the stuff I see and deal with is positive stuff. And as every week passes, new projects emerge across the world and indeed in this country. So we are moving in the right direction, and people are starting to understand that, you know, these things can not only work ecologically, but they can work socioeconomically as well. Now, that's mainly down to private landowners and NGOs getting on and doing it, rather than government policy leading the way. Government's always slow to catch up, but it will catch up eventually, especially as private finance starts to kick in to these kind of deals. And we need a whole other discussion about that. You know, it's a complex
That's
subject,
another
but
show.
The truth is that it is moving in the right direction. It's not moving fast enough, and that's the challenge. Can we keep up with climate warming? That and you know, well, it's up to people like me to make sure we do.
Well, thank you very, very much for doing the work that you do. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I really appreciate you joining us. It's genuinely been inspiring, a real reminder that nature recovery isn't just good for the planet, it's good for all of us. And so thank you very, very much. We're going to play out with your second song. So tell us the second song you've chosen and why you chose it, and then we can say goodbye to everyone as it
Thank you. Well,
plays.
first of all, thank you. I've loved it. Thanks for letting me explain my role and why I do what I do.
Pleasure.
It's a bit off the wall. It's Common People, which is a well-known pulp song, but it's William
Love it.
Shatner's version. And the reason I put
Oh.
this in is because Sense of humor is really important to me. I've always tried to, embrace humor in my work, as my colleagues will confirm, I think. And if you listen to this, it is hilarious. The way he delivers the lines is, well, I laugh out loud every time I hear it. So, just to
Oh,
keep things
brilliant.
light, I thought we'd listen to this. Yeah, brilliant. William
Love it.
Shatner,
So
Common People.
great. Well, you've been tuning into to Professor Alistair Driver. Global Rewilding is how you can get hold of him. He does have a Instagram account, which is what's your Instagram account,
Rewilding
Alistair?
driver. Rewilding driver.
Rewilding Driver. That's
Yeah.
it.
And I'm
You've
on
been listening to
LinkedIn.
Lean Into Clean. Thank you very much, UK Health Radio. And this is Common People by William Shatner. We'll see you all next week. Have a super week.